welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Our guest today says the world is at the edge of a revolution in transportation technology that will profoundly affect how we all live, work, and travel. Autonomous vehicles, the so-called self-driving car, and connected vehicles that communicate with each other, the surrounding infrastructure, and even the cloud, then respond instantly and effectively to road conditions and situations, are improving steadily. And Pennsylvania is at the forefront of that vehicle revolution. So how far away are we from self-driving vehicles, and what will it mean for the future? Our guest today is Roger Cohen, Senior Advisor to Pennsylvania Secretary of Transportation Leslie Richards. Mr. Cohen, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott. Thank you for bringing me on.
If you have a question or a comment about self-driving vehicles, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. I hope you don't mind me quoting you extensively in the introduction there, but I think that kind of says a lot about where we're going with this. I'm going to jump ahead and kind of ask the last question first in this case. When do you foresee autonomous vehicles or self-driving cars on Pennsylvania's highways and streets? And of course, I'm not talking about testing. I'm talking about legally on the road as part of our transportation network.
Well, different people have different ideas and opinions about the answer to that question on timing. The vehicle manufacturers have a very aggressive time frame, and they are obviously incentivized to deploy them as soon as they can. They're spending and investing an enormous amount on research and development. I like to go to the authorities on this, Professor Rajkumar at Carnegie Mellon University, one of the pioneers of this technology and really one of the world authorities. Has been quoted a number of times, and I use this quote in my presentations as I go around the Commonwealth talking about this issue. And he says that notwithstanding the predictions, including his own, that as we have begun to test these vehicles and expand their capability, we're learning that the road conditions, the driving conditions, are some of the most infinitely variable that any human being has to confront, or any machine has to confront for that matter. And therefore, he says, it's going to take a lot longer to bring to perfection than anyone had thought originally, including himself. And I agree with that.
You know, I think that there are many people out there who, without putting it in those exact words, could picture, could visualize many of those situations that they didn't think of ahead of time. But can you give some examples of what the professor was talking about, some of the things that weren't anticipated?
Well, the technology is suited to learn as it experiences. And so the more that it is out in the real world testing, the better it's going to get. But it's continuously confronting things like a random behavior by a vehicle or a driver that hadn't been anticipated before, or an array of, in a work zone, of cones and barriers, or debris on the roadway that comes floating across that the system is not familiar with and has difficulty recognizing and responding to.
Mm. Just those three you listed, you could see where those could cause some real problems. So where are we now with the technology?
Well, we are making tremendous advancements steadily. There are a number of leading organizations, companies, and research institutions which are testing around the world and in Pennsylvania, we're having steady improvements, but we are also mindful of the fact that recent circumstances, particularly this tragic accident in crash in Tempe, Arizona, in which a pedestrian was killed, is a reminder that human lives and safety are very much at stake as we test these vehicles, and that the stakes can't be too high.
I know a lot of people, when they heard that this would be the topic of our discussion today, that one of their first thoughts because it's so fresh in the news, was just what you mentioned, that fatal crash in Arizona a few weeks ago. I actually received an email from a law firm with details of what happened there. There was a woman walking a bicycle across the road. She was in the roadway for about 8 seconds, took her 8 seconds to go across the road. It is estimated that the vehicle had 254 feet to detect her and didn't. Obviously, this is a problem. You're not a scientist, but you are close to what is happening here. The state obviously is. So that is a situation that obviously has to be corrected.
Well, that's more information about the actual crash than I had been familiar with. But and I would not presume to get in front of an investigation. The National Transportation Safety Board is looking very closely at all the data. There's a lot of data that the system picks up from which they'll be able to draw some conclusions. It looks like it was as a layman, an unfortunate chain of events. The safety driver apparently did not have his eyes on the road. The pedestrian was not in a marked pedestrian crosswalk, and unfortunately, there was no pedestrian infrastructure anywhere near where she was crossing, which speaks to another issue about how important the infrastructure is in ensuring safety as we move forward with this. But at the end of the day, it appeared as though the system did not either pick up or recognize the victim and did not respond appropriately. So, the conclusions will be drawn from that, and hopefully learning will be taken from this tragedy, and that we'll be able to do things better.
With any kind of unknown, there is fear or at least some anxiety. But when people hear about that case, and it is the first fatal incident involving a self-driving vehicle, how do you make people, maybe I shouldn't ask the question that way, how can people feel confident in the safety of these vehicles once they're on the road?
Well, that's a very hard question because we have to balance innovation with safety. And the way innovation proceeds is through trial and error. And trial and error in settings which challenge the system so that it learns and improves. But I think that the takeaway, certainly at PennDOT and probably at state DOTs and U.S. DOT all across the country, is that we have to make sure that in that equation, that balance, that the paramount value is safety and the safety of the traveling public. After all, these are vehicles which are using the public infrastructure paid for by the public through public resources, and I think that they are owed a reasonable expectation that safety is going to be the primary value.
As you just described in this incident in Arizona, there was a human being in the car. And just out of curiosity, I mean, I don't know the answer to this question, and I'm sure many other people don't, when the self-driving vehicles are on the road, will there be a human being inside the vehicle?
Well, in Pennsylvania, currently, under current law, a human driver is required to be at the wheel, ready to take control of the vehicle under any circumstances, no matter if the car is in self-driving mode or not. There certainly will be, as we test, increasingly challenging conditions under which the car is operating entirely in autonomy. However, I think that one of the important policy questions that we are considering now, perhaps in light of the tragedy in Tempe, is that there be required to be a safety driver, and this is not decided yet, but it's being considered, with a safety driver within the vehicle or in a position, even if remotely, to be in control of the vehicle at all times while it is testing, before it is actually deployed for commercial use.
This same law firm that I mentioned to you also said that, and you just referred to it as well, that the driver who was in the human being who was in the car was not paying attention, and they found, or at least this law firm quotes research as saying that that's what they found in the testing, that humans tend to relax, that they are letting the vehicle drive itself, and as a result, they are not paying attention to the road as much as what they would be if they were actually operating the car. Again, that would be a problem as well.
Well, I wouldn't jump to the conclusion that the driver was drifting off or looking at a cell phone or
which would probably still be illegal, I would say.
It would be, but the driver may have been looking at the system display panel, but the driver was not looking at the roadway by as it appeared from the cockpit camera that was on the driver. So in that regard, I think that higher standards of operational requirements on the safety driver have to be implemented, and I think that's something that we're looking at.
Pennsylvania, as you had mentioned, has had a large role in this. And I will get to that history, but what is PennDOT's role in this? You're not a scientist, but the State Department of Transportation has taken a leading role here in Pennsylvania on AVs. Mm-hmm. What is PennDOT's role?
Well, PennDOT is responsible for the roadway infrastructure all across the Commonwealth. 40,000 miles of roads and 25,000 bridges, and we also are responsible for registering the 12 million vehicles that are on the roads and licensing the 9 million drivers. It so happens that Pennsylvania is the birthplace of this technology. It was born in Pittsburgh at Carnegie Mellon University, and in recent years, as this technology has advanced and improved and gone into actual testing, Pittsburgh has become really the global center, along with Silicon Valley, for vehicle automation technology. So we're working with our academic partners. We're working with the industry that has taken hold in Pittsburgh. And by the way, it's a very significant economic development phenomenon in Pittsburgh. It has transformed what was a declining Rust Belt city into one of the most dynamic and exciting, renaissance stories in all of America for an urban center. But we are trying to bring together all of the stakeholders to collaborate, to work together in a way that positively advances the technology for the benefits that it can bring. And I hope we get a chance to talk about that because there's a why behind this. But in the interim, as we're moving forward in testing, we want to make sure that everybody is collaborating and talking to one another as much as possible in order to ensure that safety is the paramount value.
We'll talk about what the future does look like in transportation in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest today is Roger Cohen, Senior Advisor to Pennsylvania Secretary of Transportation Leslie Richards. We're talking about the future of transportation here in Pennsylvania and across the country and probably across the world with self-driving vehicles or autonomous vehicles, as they are known, and maybe closer than we think. No one really knows for sure right now. There are apparently different opinions on when these vehicles will be on the road in mass. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Now, I want to move on to some other topics dealing with the future of transportation, but there is one more from a listener question about the crash in Arizona. Debbie from Harrisburg says, I watched the video of the vehicle accident. I thought a human driver might have hit her as well. Has the reaction time of a person being considered in this accident? I mean, is this something that, as the testing is going on, reaction time is being considered?
Well, First, let me clarify Debbie's analysis of the video. My understanding is that the camera quality outward did not adequately represent the illumination on
it
the roadway.
It was dark.
Well, the camera makes it appear as if it was pitch dark, and I understand that, in fact, there was illumination along the roadway that might have made it visible to a human driver. But the question she raises is very important, and that is, should testing have parameters that limit the operation of the vehicle in ways that don't exceed the ability for the safety driver to react and respond? And so would that mean that in a 40-mile-an-hour zone, where I believe that was the speed limit, that the car should be doing the 25 instead? So that's something that policymakers and engineers and safety experts are looking at and trying to analyze and work through.
So when that car is going 25 miles an hour in front of me, who do I yell at?
one of the very interesting issues going forward, as we start to reach the point where the road is being shared by human drivers and automated vehicles, is will people bully the polite, well-behaved machine?
Well, there could be less road rage, maybe, if that be the case. Want to take a step backwards, and again, I told you that I kind of went backwards with my questioning. In the op-ed piece that you wrote, you outlined the future of what Pennsylvania transportation looks like and where self-driving vehicles, autonomous vehicles, fit into that future. Paint a picture, if you would, of the state's transportation future and why AVs are a good part of that future.
Well, any understanding of where we're going in Pennsylvania has to be part of the overall network, transportation network in the country. And USDOT projects 30 years from now that the population of the country is going to be significantly larger, about the equal to adding another New York State, Texas, and Florida, all that populace combined. That's not all going to be spread out evenly across the continent. They're going to be along the coasts and along in the major inland corridors. And Pennsylvania is going to receive a goodly share of that increase in population. We're also anticipating a large growth in freight movement, especially now that the Panama Canal has been widened and we have larger ships coming in, calling at the Port of Philadelphia, the Port of New York, and those boxes are going to be moved as fast as possible off those ships and right down our highways. And the demand for infrastructure is going to increase dramatically. We don't have resources for major build-out of asphalt and concrete anymore. The right-of-ways are way too expensive, and the process involved is too long. There's some links that need to be built out, but basically, we're going to have to operate our infrastructure much more efficiently. And the automated technology is going to allow much closer operation effectively and smoothly and safely when technology is perfected. And I want to make sure that that's always in people's minds when I say this, so that we're going to make much more efficient use. We'll reduce congestion. It will move the higher demands more efficiently. And first and foremost, it's going to, in all likelihood, overall reduce crashes, hopefully dramatically. We have a public health crisis, which is ongoing. I know your next guest is going to talk about the opioid crisis, which is a very recent phenomenon in public health. But, you know, the carnage on the highways, we now have 37,000 people a year dying. That's 100 people a day in this country. And that's year in, year out. It had been going down steadily over decades because of increases in safety equipment, seat belts, airbags. But then it started to inch back up, and over since this decade began, it's up about 15%. And that doesn't even include the hundreds of thousands of people who are seriously injured, who are chronically injured, and Combine that with the property damage and the loss of productivity, you're talking about hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars taken out of our economy every year, which could be better put to use for things like education, the arts, medical research, natural resource conservation, all these good things that resources are scarce for.
When you say that it will be more efficient, in what way?
Well, the systems will connect with each other so that vehicles will allow themselves to be able to be continuously aware of one another. They have 360-degree perception, and they operate and respond to conditions, when perfected, in milliseconds rather than 1 or 2 seconds. So in that regard, they're going to be able to operate in much closer quarters. They're going to not have the same stop and go patterns which lead to congestion. And the biggest cause of congestion, frankly, is crashes. And you're going to be able to reduce crashes significantly. I think there's consensus in engineering and safety community that's the end game which we're really aiming for. And it's, in fact, that safety advantage over the long term, which is why PennDOT and other DOTs and the public sector is dedicated to trying to advance this.
The prototypes that we have seen so far appear to be either sedan vehicles, crossovers, SUVs, and in some cases, vans, fairly small. What about tractor trailers? Because when you're talking about hauling freight today, that's one of the main hubs of transportation, if you will, is tractor trailers. Will there be autonomous tractor trailers?
There will be automated trucking in which the trucks combine into convoys and operate in very close quarters. In fact, there was legislation that passed the State House of Representatives, which will allow for that on our roadways. This is going to allow for much more efficient and easier operation. I do not foresee anytime soon that truck drivers will be out of the cab in long-haul trucking. I know that there are a lot of concerns about workforce with respect to this technology. They're legitimate concerns, and they need to be addressed. I don't think that we're going to see truck drivers disappear. In fact, it's the opposite in the trucking business, that there's a tremendous shortage of truck drivers because it's a very hard job to do. Making the work conditions easier should help the truck driver operate much more beneficially for him.
It also would seem to be what people would be most anxious about on the highway, a large tractor trailer without a driver.
Well, the economics of trucking today results in they have to do their 11 hours and then they're off, and that's why they're racing down that highway as fast as they can to deliver. If they don't make their delivery, if they get caught in congestion, then they're stuck waiting for a dispatcher to give them a delivery bay, and they're not getting paid, and they might even be penalized because the supply chain requires just-in-time delivery to keep production costs down. So if one thing that automation may well do, and the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration is starting to think about it, is maybe extend the hours of service so that they'd be able to drive longer under better conditions, and hopefully then they would operate more safely.
Our guest during this portion of the program is Roger Cohen, Senior Advisor to Pennsylvania Secretary of Transportation Leslie Richards. We're talking about autonomous vehicles, self-driving vehicles. We have about 10 minutes left in this segment of the program. If you'd like to get a question in, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532, or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. By the way, coming up in the second portion of the program, we're going to be talking about a new report that just shows a tremendous increase in the number of babies that are born addicted to are born to mothers who are addicted to drugs, and the impact that has on those newborn babies. Mr. Cohen, we had a question here from a listener wants to know, why is the Commonwealth devoting its limited budget to IT technology that only perpetrates the century-old internal combustion engine rather than investing in sustainable technologies for EVs, electronic vehicles, and high-speed rail?
Well, those are two different transportation options, and they have two different answers. I think that electric vehicles are clearly the trend line for the future. PennDOT supports and encourages that. Vehicle automation is going to be conducive to that. You're already packing some serious electronics into the vehicle that are battery operated, and as battery capability improves, the two technologies are going to converge.
So there's not going to be an AV stopping at a gas station and someone having to pump gas.
Well, the AV technology itself is propulsion agnostic. It can go either way, but we do see that the industry is headed toward the electric vehicle future, and we support that. It does have some serious implications for our ability to raise revenue in order to keep the infrastructure in a state of good repair, because the gasoline tax has been for some time becoming less of an effective tool, and soon will be obsolete. And in order for AVs to operate on the infrastructure has to be maximally maintained. So where I said we're not going to be building out, we're going to be putting more of our resources into maintenance, and it will be very important that there be a revenue source for that.
Don is in Lancaster. Don, you're on the air. Hello, Don?
Hi, speaking.
Yes, go ahead.
Hey, my question was regarding the incident that happened in Arizona. I'm curious about the decision-making capability of the AI in the vehicle. If it were a two-lane road and a vehicle was in the passing lane or the left lane and the car was able to detect that person, what decision will be made in order to avoid the collision with the person versus the vehicle in the left lane?
In other words, there are options, as there often are on the road, right? Decisions have to be made.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you for your call.
Well, I don't want to address that with respect to Tempe, because that's a matter of
investigation.
But Don raises a good point, and that is how will the vehicle respond as all kinds of variables arise? And, you know, it is a matter of a safe testing environment. An environment which safely provides for the security of everybody around it, and having that experience and building that experience into its decision-making software, and while doing so, then sharing that knowledge with other vehicles. That's one advantage that AVs have over the human, is that each of us learns to drive individually, and the vehicles are able to share their learning as they go.
Bobby is in Quarryville. Bobby, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I want to know, is it going to be possible for a blind person to get into one of these cars and put in the information that the GPS needs and go somewhere?
Bobby raises a great question, and one of the great benefits that this technology will provide, and that is that people who currently do not have access to transportation because of disability will have new opportunities for mobility utilizing this technology. So the answer, in short, is yes, and that's one of the benefits of automated vehicle technology going forward.
Is my assumption correct, though, that someone who is sight impaired would not be behind the wheel as the human driver in this case, or is that an incorrect assumption?
Well, if we're talking about testing, I think that we're going to see testing safety of drivers for the foreseeable future. We're talking about deployment long down the road when we get to the end game. I think that it's quite likely that we're going to see vehicles which, whether it's voice activated or some other mechanism, that people with disability will be able to get in the vehicle and go where they want to go without having to rely on somebody else. They'll gain independence that probably never had before.
You talked about PennDOT's role in this. What changes will have to be made to the infrastructure in the laws of the roadways once this becomes widespread, or do we know?
We don't know yet, that's part of the learning process. You know, we're gathering next week in Pittsburgh for a summit on automated vehicles, and one of the speakers is one of the leading legal theorists. He's from the University of South Carolina. He's coming up, and he and a lawyer from PennDOT and a lawyer from Ford Motor Company and another are going to be talking about what the vehicle code in 2050 is going to look like. And that's actually a fascinating topic, which we could spend another hour on. But it's very much a moving target.
Listener had a question about privacy. Earlier on in the program, you mentioned the government have access to locations. Are there privacy issues being addressed, or is this far-fetched?
Not far-fetched. Serious and important issue. I think that this comes up in the context of a much wider conversation in our country and in the world about what the digital society is all about and what people have a right to expect from their technology and what the society has a right to expect with respect to, you know, who controls data and what kinds of privacy can we be assured of. I think that it's part of that larger conversation, I think that it raises what is one of a number of significant issues. And one of the reasons that PennDOT is involved is because there are possible unintended consequences, not always so great, that it's very important for the public to be engaged in this kind of a conversation as the technology moves forward. It's not always the best thing to leave everything to the experts and the policymakers and the engineers. This is really a thing for the public to be engaged in a very granular way.
Speaking of which, who will have the final say on when this happens and how it happens?
Well, if we're talking about commercial deployment, I believe and hope that that final say will be exercised by the federal government through the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration, which has years of capability in validating the safety of vehicles and putting them out there for commercial use. As far as how this proceeds in terms of testing and what the roadways should look like, I think that the states, as the laboratories of democracy, should be trying different things and what the infrastructure looks like, what the rules of the road are. So I think that there's for the interim period, I think it's appropriate for the states to be taking a lead role that they are, and then that the federal government steps in and says, we're ready and we have a uniform system across the continent.
Roger Cohen is Senior Advisor to Pennsylvania Secretary of Transportation Leslie Richards. Mr. Cohen, fascinating conversation. I never thought I would live to see this day. Maybe I will. I don't know. But
we still have a ways.
Thank you very much for being with
us today.
Thank
you, Scott. It's a pleasure.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. The opioid crisis has killed thousands of people with overdoses, ruined people's lives, and torn apart families. But perhaps one of the saddest aspects of the epidemic is babies born to women who were addicted and experienced the pain of withdrawal. A new report from the Pennsylvania Healthcare Cost Containment Council indicates the rate of newborns suffering from drug withdrawal or neonatal abstinence syndrome increased more than 1,000% between the year 2000 and 2017 in Pennsylvania. Our guest is Joe Martin, Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Healthcare Cost Containment Council, to talk about the report. Joe, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on, Scott.
Let me get you. There we go. 1-800-729-7532 is the number to call if you have a question about this report, a comment about the situation. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Joe Martin, that 1,000% increase in the rate of babies born who are suffering from withdrawal is what stands out in the report. Provide some context.
Well, the one of the issues that has not really been focused on all that much in the opioid crisis is the issue of newborns and how they are affected by the drug use of the mother involved. So the report that we just published focuses on something called neonatal abstinence syndrome. And what that means simply is that the mother becomes addicted to drugs during her pregnancy. And as a matter of course there, when the baby is born, the baby will then show signs of withdrawal. And essentially, babies are being born already addicted to opioids like heroin or cocaine, and also pain medication like Vicodin and OxyContin. So the rate of babies born with this went from a little over 1 per 1,000 newborns, and it skyrocketed to 15, more than 15 per 1,000 newborns over the course of 16 years. And just 2,000 babies in Pennsylvania were born addicted just last year alone.
So is there a year in particular when you saw a jump in the number of babies that were born with neonatal abstinence syndrome?
It's been a pretty steady increase from the beginning of when we measured this. But it tracks with what we see in the adult population as well. So we're seeing the same kind of trend with these newborns as we do with adults.
What addictive drugs are we talking about?
Well, we're talking about heroin, including fentanyl. We're talking about cocaine. We're talking about Vicodin, OxyContin, and other types of pain medications like that.
You mentioned that this followed the trend of the opioid crisis. Are there more drugs, are there more opioids that hospitals across the state are seeing that the mothers are addicted to those drugs more often?
Well, one of the really alarming trends that we've seen has been the increase in synthetic drugs, so like fentanyl, and then there are other derivatives that are similar to that that are being manufactured here in the United States and also are being manufactured in other countries where people are obtaining them over the internet. So, and these are very, very deadly. Heroin is certainly very addictive and can be deadly, but these drugs are much more dangerous.
You know, you're not a medical professional, but in the course of the research, I'm sure that you have heard stories of how these babies, the symptoms that these babies present. A baby gone through withdrawal, first of all, it's just horrible to have to think about it, but what symptoms do they present when they are going through withdrawal?
It is a terrible thing because, you know, we've all seen or read about or, you know, seen movies about adults being addicted and going through withdrawal and how painful that can be for an adult. So imagine a brand new baby going through the same kinds of withdrawal symptoms. So they are very sensitive to touch. They're in a lot of pain. They're very subject to additional complications that such as respiratory distress, low birth weight. They're often premature, and other types of complicating factors. And those are the kinds of things that will follow them, you know, and have an impact on them in a negative way as they go further on in life.
How are these babies diagnosed? I mean, is the mother going into the situation when the mother is about to give birth, Do the medical professionals, does the hospital know that that mother is addicted? Do they admit that they are addicted? Is that how it is diagnosed in the baby, or are there situations where there's no idea and the baby is born and you realize, when I say you, those who are providing the treatment realize right off the bat that, that there's an issue?
Well, I think there are going to be a range of scenarios there. But the hospital record as a result of testing when the mother is admitted and so on will show the presence of one of these substances in the system. And so there were more than 3,000 cases last year where there was a presence of a substance in the system, and the baby is not always born addicted. So, but in 60% of those cases, the baby is born addicted. So it's very prevalent.
Why is that the baby's not always born addicted? Because let's face it, when the baby is in the womb, it's getting its nourishment, it's getting its blood from the mother and all that. How does it happen?
I think it's just a matter of luck, really. Perhaps the mother wasn't quite as addicted and didn't have as much of a long-term addiction process going on. But it's a little bit of a mystery as to how that happens.
Are there some drugs that are more addictive to the babies than others?
That's an excellent question. I don't know that there are drugs that are more addictive necessarily. There are certainly drugs that are more dangerous. So heroin, fentanyl, for example, it's a matter of degree, but are going to be relatively or comparably more dangerous than something like a pain medication.
That fentanyl is just, we've heard many times on this program how often it is increasing now that the people who are thinking they're getting heroin or that they know that there's fentanyl there to get a bigger high, and it is so dangerous. In some cases, providing it's 100% or 100 times, I should say, more powerful than heroin. And to think that going into a little baby, again, just a horrible thought about that. If you're tuning in right now, our guest is Jill Martin, Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Healthcare Cost Containment Council. We're talking about a report that PH4C put out last week that looks at the number of babies that are being born here in Pennsylvania, the rate of babies being born here in Pennsylvania that are addicted to drugs, suffering from neonatal abstinence syndrome. We have about 10 minutes left in the program. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. To learn more about the opioid crisis, plus a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health, From Policy to Personal Choices. We're taking a comprehensive look at today's health system. Online at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, Penn State Health, and WellSpan Health. I'm curious, Joe, and I don't know whether you can answer this question or not, because you are not a medical professional, but how are these babies treated? What's the treatment for withdrawal?
Excellent question. In some ways, it's the same treatment that an adult would receive. So they'll be given methadone, and they'll be weaned, essentially, off the drug, and their withdrawal symptoms will lessen. Another very innovative way that's being employed takes into account volunteers who come in and essentially nurture these children. So they'll spend long periods of time. A lot of senior citizens volunteered to do this, which is a wonderful thing. Long periods of time just holding them and cuddling them and talking to them. And that provides a tremendous amount of comfort while they're going through these painful withdrawal symptoms. But some babies can't be held. They are so sensitive to touch because of these symptoms that they're going through that's not an option for them.
you touched on this, but wanted to bring some numbers to it as well, that some of the other symptoms that these babies show, low birth weights, prematurity, difficulty feeding, and the respiratory distress, that all those things increase. And you actually have the numbers to back those up.
Well, in general, you're going to see the rate of complications for these children to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 2.5 times what a normal newborn would be experiencing if they were having some complications. So for low birth weight babies, a normal rate would be about 6.5%, and the rate for these kids that are going through withdrawal is going to be closer to 16%. You see those kinds of differences across those complication categories. The thing that I'd like to just mention relates to what it costs to treat these kids. We saw over $14 million in insurance payments. $14 million in 1 year just last year. And that's coming from the public sector and the private sector. These are actual dollars being paid to treat these kids, and this is just for their hospital stay. So to just give you some perspective, I was talking to somebody the other day who had a granddaughter who was in the neonatal intensive care unit for 5 days. And this was not a drug-addicted baby. This was a normal childbirth, but had to be in the NICU for 5 days. The bill there was $50,000. So these are very expensive to deal with. And we're just looking at the hospitalization. It's a snapshot. And these problems are often going to follow these kids as they go further on in life. You know, you're going to have learning disability problems and so on. So the cost that we're looking at, that $14 million in 1 year, is just the tip of the iceberg.
We have a question along those lines from Susan in Lancaster. Susan, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, good morning. I know this situation is just horrific. My question, though, is after the baby is brought through the protocol of, I guess you'd call it rehab, you know, to detoxify, what sequence of events is in place then in terms of where the baby goes? Is it removed from the mother? What is in place for the mother? Is there legalities involved in terms of, you know, child neglect, child abuse, since you're pregnant and you're, you know, doing substances that's doing this to your newborn? What happens afterwards? That's what I'd like to know. And
Susan,
I'll take my comment off the air.
Thank you very much, and some great questions.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I'm sure that all of those factors start to come into play as the social services community starts to play their role in this. I'm not an expert on Child Protective Services, so I don't want to speak in too many specifics on that. But certainly that's going to be a factor after the birth occurs.
And by the way, we're going to explore this issue in the future and bring in some medical professionals of what they actually see in the ERs, in the hospital when these babies are delivered. You were talking about the cost, $14 million just to the hospitals. What about, and you also mentioned that it's a combination of private and public, but there was a great majority of it being paid by Medicaid, right?
That's correct. The large majority of these cases in other situations that we've looked at in terms of newborns and drugs is being paid by Medicaid, which, of course, is the state's healthcare program for low-income children. The low-income population.
What percentage is that? I know you have to refer to your notes, but I believe I remember seeing 86%.
That's correct.
86% being paid for by taxpayers.
That's correct. So the impact of this is felt economically as well. I know we're all primarily concerned about these babies and what they're going through, but there is an economic effect to this, and the state Medicaid budget is generally a big issue when it comes to budget time, and this has an impact.
your research also, and you do this with everything that you research, so this is nothing unusual. You break it down by race and ethnicity as well.
Well, one of the things that, you know, without getting too much into the weeds on this, one of the things that we see in the newborn situation as well as the adult addiction situation is that this drug addiction problem is an equal opportunity destroyer of lives, of families, of communities. It defies every socioeconomic and geographic and demographic category. It affects old and young. It affects rich and poor. It affects rural and urban. And it affects all races. So we're seeing it in whites and in African Americans and Hispanics. There are dramatic increases all across the board.
From what I did see, though, it is most prevalent amongst whites. What about quickly income levels?
Well, the income level issue is a little confounding because we see that the large percentage of these are Medicaid. At the same time, when you look at the population, it cuts across the income categories as well. So it's not just the poor.
Joe Martin is the executive director of the Pennsylvania Healthcare Cost Containment Council. Joe, this research is very valuable and tells us a lot and hopefully gets a lot of people thinking. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Coming up on Monday's program, we'll be discussing clean water here in Pennsylvania. There was a report out that said that the Pennsylvania industries exceeded their clean water rules by about, much more, second most in the country. That comes up on Monday's program.